We turn now to the second case of the morning, appeal number 23-3094, United States v. James Weiss. Okay, so we have Mr. Yusorovich at the stand. You can correct my pronunciation.
Good morning to the court. Attorney Ilya Osharovich on behalf of the defendant, appellant, Mr. James T. Weiss. Your Honors, this case tests whether federal agents exceeded their limited authority when they interrogated Mr. Weiss, who was detained pursuant to a search warrant without reading a Miranda rights. In Michigan v. Summers, the United States Supreme Court held that search warrant detentions are not likely to be exploited by the officer or unduly prolonged in order to gain more information, because the information the officers seek normally will be obtained through the search and not through the detention. In United States,
if we find that Weiss's interview with the FBI was voluntarily given, does that necessarily mean that the interview was not unduly prolonged?
It was unduly prolonged. Even if you find it's voluntary, it's still unduly prolonged, but the court can't find it's voluntary because all of the actions were directed by the police department and they completely by the law enforcement agency, and they completely dominated the environment. So it can't be considered voluntary. Mr. Weiss was seized pursuant to a search warrant involuntarily, and I'll get to that part in explaining it. For example, in United States versus Burns, this circuit held that absent special circumstances or possibly a prolonged detention, in the usual case, a person detained during the execution of a search warrant is not in custody for purposes of Miranda. Here, there are special circumstances in that Mr. Weiss was the actual target of the search warrant. Unlike Mattel, Carey, Summers, and other cases, there they were just seizures of people who were present on the premises to be searched. Here, Mr. Weiss himself was the actual target. His body and his person was to be seized and searched. Moreover, the questioning of Mr. Weiss was not limited in scope and duration to officer safety, to evidence, or opening doors. It went beyond. It was solely elicited. It was designed to elicit incriminating testimony without Miranda.
How do we deal with the fact that the agents approached Mr. Weiss after, you know, he pulled over and said they had some questions they needed to speak to him about, and he said, sure, and asked if he needed to step out of his vehicle.
Well,
then he did, and he went and he sat in the car.
Well, that again, the initial seizure was involuntary. So what they did was they gave a show of authority. He then submitted to that authority and was no longer free to leave. If he tried to leave, he would have violated federal law or state law. Then when they directed him, they told him, you have to move your car to another location. He responded to that. There was no voluntary action. He complied with their orders.
He repeatedly stated that he wanted to cooperate with them.
Correct.
And of course he left to retrieve his phone and returned.
Well, the issue is that when they approached this car, they used the word need. They didn't say, hey, Mr. Weiss, can we speak with you? Hey, do you have a chance to talk to us? They said, we need to talk to you. So given the show of authority, the removal to another location, then telling him we need, he says, okay, sure. Do you want me to get out or not? He's asking, what do you want me to do in response to their command? They then tell him to get out of the car, which is his orders, the officer's orders. He gets out, and the key thing is they told him to disable his vehicle. So everything he did in response was to their actions. But addressing the part where he says, I'll voluntary talk. Everybody is voluntary talking when there's a Miranda warning. I mean, when there's a Miranda issue, that's the whole issue. They gave statements, they all talk voluntarily. But here, that voluntary statement came in the middle of the interview after it already started, before they gave a Miranda. So when you go back...
Counsel, I'm looking at the transcript from the initial encounter here. So Agent Heidi, we need to chat with you about a couple things. Weiss responds, sure. Do you want me to get out of my car? Heidi responds, if you want to jump in the back and get in with us real quick, you're not under arrest or anything like that. And then he continues, we just have a couple things we want to talk to you about. So I want to tease out that language because there was a clear statement by the agent, you're not under arrest. Is it your view that the use of need a couple seconds before erases that? Because clearly the agent said you're not under arrest.
Well, right. But that also, whether he was under arrest or not, that's just a talismanic statement, because during the trial, the officer said he wasn't free to leave from the moment we stopped him until that search warrant was executed. And they deviated from the search into an interrogation. So it changed the nature of the underlying search. So whether he was under arrest, that's not the issue. The issue is he was seized pursuant to a search warrant. He wasn't free to leave. And it is akin to a formal arrest. But
And when you say he wasn't free to leave, you're basing that on the verb we need to chat. What are the other circumstances?
There was a show of authority that he submitted.
Show of authority,
which is the activation of the lights.
That the lights is what you're talking about.
Well, that's one part.
Okay.
Then the moving him to a location, directing him to go somewhere, right, of their choosing, so that the public would not be any wiser. They secluded him from the public by choosing those locations. Then they moved him to a third location, which was a mobile interrogation room, which is the police car. In the police car, they told him those statements, but he still wasn't free to leave. It was, and the agents admitted that. They said until that search warrant was fully executed, he couldn't leave anywhere because they stopped him, one, pursuant to the search warrant, two, they were worried he was going to destroy evidence. And even though he was allowed to walk out of his car to get his phone, the entire time the agents were next to him. And that's the same thing in Mattel Carey. The agents were with him 24 the entire time. But here, there's another issue, is that the questioning, we don't just look at the detention. See, and that's what I was trying to get to. For example, other federal courts addressing this issue have faulted law enforcement agents for exceeding that limited authority granted in Summers when interrogating suspects were seized pursuant to a search warrant. In Mattel Carey, the First Circuit held such questioning without Miranda must be limited to seeking identification, verifying, dispelling suspicions of criminal conduct, or maintaining the status quo while obtaining more information. The First Circuit held that a suspect who's seized as an occupant of the premises subject to a duly issued search warrant is entitled to be free from excessive questioning intended to elicit incriminating statements or information. So in Kim, in the Ninth Circuit, the court found that that asking more than a few questions to determine a person's identity or dispel the suspicions of criminal activity is beyond the scope of the lawful detention prescribed by Summers. And then in Knapp, this Ninth Circuit went further and found that a seizure becomes unlawful when it is more intrusive than necessary, and it prohibits officers from exploiting the seizure to obtain more information than normally would be found in a search. Hence, the spirit of the law throughout the entire country is that the questioning without Miranda in a search warrant situation must be limited in scope and duration. The scope of the detention, forget there's an interrogation and detention, the scope of the detention must be carefully tailored to its underlying justification. Since the justification for a search warrant detention is to prevent the suspect from fleeing the scene, to ensure the safety of officers, and to help facilitate an efficient and orderly search, the detention of the target of a search warrant, like Mr. Weiss, he wasn't just an occupant of the premise, he's the actual target. These same standards have to apply. So here, the extensive interrogation at issue didn't support any of these factors, and the questions were not limited in scope and duration. Therefore, the interrogation of Mr. Weiss, whether he was voluntary or told he's not under arrest, was not carefully tailored to the detention's underlying justification. So it was more intrusive than necessary. And that's where the Ninth Circuit combined the Fourth and the Fifth Amendment, kind of, to summarize it with, they took Summers and they combined it there so that there isn't an exception to Miranda that's carved out. And that's what the district court did here. They carved out an exception to Miranda in search warrant cases. And that's a big issue. So there's also...
I'd like to take you just a little, because time flees and we have a couple of issues here. But are you arguing that the contents of Mr. Weiss's phone should be suppressed.
We are arguing that anything, no, we, the contents of the phone is not really our dispute, it's the actual statements. The contents of the phone really had no evidence on it that was used at the trial, so it's not really that important to us. It's the actual statements, because those statements were key to the false statements charge and to the honest crimes and the bribery and the wire fraud. But and this goes back to what Your Honor asked me. There's no question Mr. Weiss was in custody. The entire context of the questioning, including the place and length of interrogation, demonstrated that the course of investigation was police dominated. Here, the police assumed complete control over the interrogation site and the course of conduct followed by the defendant. They chose the location to stop. They chose when to activate their lights, forcing Mr. Weiss to submit to their show of authority. This wasn't a restaurant where someone's on the Gold Coast and they stop someone and say, hey, can we talk to you? They physically pulled them over with a show of authority and a search warrant. So,
well, what do you think would have occurred if he had not repeatedly stated, I want to cooperate with you?
That's irrelevant because, again, the officers were only allowed to stop him to search his person and take the phone. That was the justification for the detention. They went beyond that when they deviated into an interrogation. So even if he said, I want to cooperate, that was mid in the interview, but he still has to be given his Miranda warnings. Everybody talks. Everybody, when they're asked questions in custody, the people answer the questions, then a motion to suppress comes. So they're always voluntarily speaking. But to make sure that it's voluntary, the Supreme Court said we have to give these people the rights so that they understand and they're aware of their rights and so they're not taken advantage of by law enforcement.
What about Mr. Weiss's comments, I'm not a rookie, that he was willing to cooperate, wanted to cooperate? I mean, he seemed to have an understanding that he could go, no?
No, I don't think he had an understanding that he could go, but I think when he says I'm not a rookie and those things, that's doesn't matter because the Fifth Amendment and the Fourth Amendment are there. Whether you're a rookie, whether you're a pro, whether you're a little kid, you still have those rights. They don't disappear based on your education level or how smart you are or how many times you've been involved in the legal system. These are the rules. This is how it works. And so one of the things that, and I've gone through what they, you know, the FBI admitted he's not free to leave. Once they seized him, he's not going anywhere. So that brings the idea that the best way to keep someone in prison is to make them think they're free. And we can't have the officers hiding search warrants from their targets to get interrogations. And so it's important. This is probably one of the more important parts. And then I'll stop because I did reserve only 5 minutes for this argument and then 10 rebuttal. But it's important to note Mr. Weiss was the focus of the search warrant and the investigation. And this awareness contributes to the sense of custody. This case has to be distinguished from other cases where being the focus of an investigation was only given minimal weight since the individuals in those other cases were just occupants detained on the premises to be searched. Here, Mr. Weiss was made aware of that the agents were looking into his interactions with the Royal, and he was actually the target. This is not like Summers, where they come to a house and they find someone who's present in the place. Mr. Weiss was ordered to be arrested, searched, and seized, and released. And what I mean by that, arrested for purposes of the search warrant, to be seized. So there's no question he was in custody and they elicited incriminating testimony. All they had to do was just read him his Miranda or execute the search warrant. And going back to what Your Honor Rother said, the issue is they prolonged this detention. It should have only taken 10 to 15 minutes to take his phone. Instead, they spent an hour and a half because they deviated from the search. They began it, they executed the search warrant by stopping him, and then during the search, they just went into interrogation. The warrant only allowed them to seize and search him, not interrogate him. So affirming the district court in this matter would carve out an exception to Miranda and search warrant cases, which would be contrary to our sister courts and the Supreme, to our sister circuits and the Supreme Court in Summers, which found that a search warrant detention is not likely to be exploited by the officer or unduly prolonged in order to gain more information, because the information the officers seek normally will be obtained through the search and not through the detention. And that's what happened here. They used the search, they used the detention to get more information than they would from the search. And that's exactly what the United States Supreme Court prohibited. There's just no case that we found that addresses when the target of the warrant is seized.
Isn't the length of the interview attributable to Mr. Weiss's voluntary cooperation with the agents?
No, it is not. It's because the length of the interview, again, is it was them asking him questions involuntarily. They put him in a car, they pulled him over, they seized him, and they deviated. But again, the courts have held that anytime someone is seized pursuant to a search warrant, they have a right to be free from being forced to question, to obtain illicit, or to obtain incriminating statements. So basically, the First Circuit has said that a person who's seized pursuant to a search warrant that's based on the premises, when they find someone on the premises, is entitled to be free from excessive questioning, entitled to elicit incriminating information. So whether it was voluntary...
Are you arguing, by the way, that the existence of a search warrant made Mr. Weiss feel like he could not leave?
No, not at that time, because he didn't know about it. But the existence of a search warrant is a responsibility of the officers to not deviate past the justifications in that search warrant. So cooperation or not, he had a right.
So you're trying to say that if the officer has the warrant in their back pocket and they ask the person, will you speak with us or will you answer our questions, that they cannot do that if the person consents,
a difference. What you're saying is the warrant's in the back pocket and the person wasn't seized pursuant to the warrant yet. Once those lights came on in the police car, that warrant came out of the back pocket. He was in custody, and at that time, he was to be free from excessive questioning intended to elicit incriminating information. So if this court affirms this district court, they will carve out an exception to Miranda and search warrant cases, contrary to our sister circuits and Summers. If he was just a premises occupant, where they raided a house and they found someone sitting there who's not on the search warrant, then he gets less protections. But here, when he's the actual target, there's no question that he gets these protections. So I used all my time, but this was our main issue. So at this time, I think we're completed.
I suspect we'll want to hear from you again, Mr. Usarovich, so you'll be back.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. O'Neill.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Christine O'Neill on behalf of the United States. The District Court committed no error denying defendant's motion to suppress his statements to law enforcement. The question before the District Court was whether the defendant was in custody and should have been Mirandized, and the Court applied the correct legal standard, citing United States versus Patterson, which is whether a reasonable person in the defendant's position would have believed he was free to leave.
May I stop you, because I'd like to ask you about, you know, the initial stop. What level of suspicion did the FBI agents have to have when they initially pulled Mr. Weiss over? And what precise evidence exists in the record to show that the agents had that requisite level of suspicion?
That is a very interesting question, Your Honor, that was not briefed before the district court, because no one was challenging the search warrant that was lawfully issued for the defendant. I would say, though, that the officers also had reasonable suspicion here to stop him based on his involvement in the crime that was laid out in the search warrant affidavit. But as this was argued below and presented to the district court, the stop was pursuant to the lawfully executed search warrant. That doesn't change defendant's ability to voluntarily consent to an interview with law enforcement. As Judge Maldonado was asking Mr. Usarovich, law enforcement is allowed to talk to someone despite the fact that they may have a search warrant in their back pocket. There were no disputes in the record about the facts here. Defendant never asked for a hearing on these issues, and the district court found that the defendant voluntarily accepted the invitation to join the FBI inside their vehicle. The defendant was never physically restrained at any time. He was told he was not under arrest. He was told twice that the interview was voluntary. And as has already been discussed this morning, the defendant said three times that he wanted to cooperate throughout this 90-minute interview.
Can you respond to Mr. Usarovich's argument that the warrant was not in the back pocket? They activated the warrant, and at that point, there is a concern under the case law about prolonging, et cetera, and his argument that we would be carving out an exception under Miranda.
Yes, Your Honor. There is no doubt that the FBI stopped Mr. Weiss pursuant to that search warrant. He was pulled over in order to execute the search warrant. But then they initiated a voluntary conversation with him. And that is what makes this different than the cases that defendant cites where a search warrant is being executed. Those cases that Mr. Usarovich is arguing about are almost every single one of them involves the FBI or law enforcement breaking down a door at 6 a.m. In Mitchell Carey, it was 8. In one of the other cases, it was 20 law enforcement flooding a person's house, guns drawn, and then they put the person on the couch and say, "You're free to go. We just have a few questions if you want to answer them." That is a very different situation than what happened here with Mr. Weiss. The cases about prolonging an interrogation while executing a search warrant do not apply because the agents here were not executing the search warrant throughout the encounter. They did stop him pursuant to it, but then they proceeded into a voluntary encounter that the defendant prolonged repeatedly. He never asked to leave the vehicle. His statements themselves reflected the voluntariness of the conversation. He makes jokes with the agents about borrowing money from them. They could have followed him to his lunch meeting and paid for the meeting. He says, "I'm not a rookie." He says, "I have nothing to hide." On the issue about, I'm sorry. Oh, I thought I heard Judge Rovner. My apologies.
I think so. Judge Rovner, were we?
No, I'd like her to finish.
On the issue of whether at trial, Special Agent Heidi testified that the defendant was not free to leave, I think if you read through the cross-examination and the redirect, it becomes clear that what Special Agent Heidi was saying was that, you know, the question posed by defense counsel was he free to leave before you executed the search warrant? And Special Agent Heidi truthfully answered no. On redirect, it was clarified, well, what would have happened if when you pulled him over, you would have said, "We're executing this search warrant and we'd like you to talk to us," and he said no. They would have finished executing the search warrant and he would have been free to leave. There would have been no way to undergo this interview pursuant to the search warrant. And the FBI acknowledged that during the trial testimony.
Can we get to, unless my colleagues have more questions on this, I want to go to official act.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm struggling with the definition of official act the district court gave, because promoting the enactment of legislation could mean anything. You know, if Arroyo had a Facebook account and the Facebook account of his face lobbying firm liked a pro sweepstakes legislation post by Weiss, that could be seen as promoting the enactment of legislation. I mean, what would that qualify as an official act? Where do we draw the line on promoting the enactment of legislation? As a corollary to that, I want you to tell me where the court got this language from, because that's not the language the government proposed with the jury instruction. Your jury instruction just talked about the enactment of legislation, not promoting. It seems to me the district court added the word promoting.
Your Honor, I'd be happy to address the official act definition that was given by the district court. So to answer the first part of your question first, there was no plain error with the district court's instruction, and it was an accurate statement of the law. If you look at this instruction, which we call in our brief instruction A, that explains the official act at issue. In connection with instruction B, the bribery instructions, that is where the nuance, as Your Honor is asking about, is fleshed out. If you look at instruction B, it does explain kind of where the line is. It says that a public official makes a decision or takes action on a question when he uses his official position to exert pressure or advise another official. It goes on to say all of the things that defendant wants it to say as he argues before this court. A public official does not make a decision or take action on a question, matter, cause, or proceeding if he does no more than set up a meeting, host an event, or call or talk to another public official. In the context of this case, Your Honor, there was no confusion here. Reading these two instructions together and with the evidence that was presented. In the spring of 2019, the defendant and Arroyo are doing everything that they can to get this legislation passed. This is very different than McDonnell, where the concern about official action comes from. In McDonnell, payments were made to the governor of Virginia, and he then hosts meetings and starts conversations to learn more about the drug that the people paying him the money are asking him to learn more about. Here, our public official, Arroyo, takes money from the defendant, and then he is going out and speaking at committee hearings. He is approaching the three sponsors of the bill, all of whom testified at trial, Munoz, Rita, and Link, and aggressively encouraging them to include this in the legislation. Also importantly, at the time, you know, I know promoting the enactment of sounds a little vague on its face, but at the time this is all happening, this legislation is pending in May of 2019 before the Illinois General Assembly. It ultimately dies. They did not succeed. But then when they picked this up again in August with the bribes of Senator Link trying to buy his official action, they're considering a trailer bill to try to sweep this legislation back in. So it is very much on the table as something that could have been changed by the actions that defendant was taking. Your Honor, respectfully, I do think that the government promotes the promoting, and the reason that I think that is because I don't have our initial proposal in front of me, but I do have our indictment, and promoting the enactment of legislation is in the speaking indictment. So whether it was proposed by the government or by the district court, I believe that is where that language initially comes from the indictment in this case.
But we don't have a case. The government can't point us to a case that defines promoting the enactment of legislation as an official act.
No, Your Honor. We cannot point you to a case that used that specific definition of official act. The pattern calls for us to describe the act at issue. And so that is what the parties were doing here. It's also important to note, Your Honor, that the defendant never proposed an alternate definition of official act. Throughout the two written filings of the jury instructions and the numerous jury instructions conferences that we had before the district court, they never proposed another definition of official act, and the pattern calls upon us to do that.
You know, I know that the government's argument is that Weiss forfeited any objections to the jury instructions. He does claim that he objected to the inclusion of that sentence in R302, but the written objections there don't include an objection to that sentence. And separately, of course, during the two jury instructions, as you mentioned, the court asked repeatedly if there were any other issues with the jury instructions, and there was silence about the inclusion of that sentence. So any review that we would have would be, as you noted, for plain error.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor, and I believe that defendant in their brief concedes that plain error review applies here, or at least seems to concede that. I would also note that the waiver here is significant because the objections that defendant did raise in R302, that they wanted all three verbs included in the first section of instruction A, and the nuances that they wanted in instruction B, that all got in. They got everything they asked for here. So had they raised this below, perhaps it would have turned out differently, but they did not.
And how do you explain the language, the fact that the jury instruction at issue says agreed in part below it?
It says agreed in part because the defendant did not propose anything for the second bracketed sentence. And so they were not agreeing to our proposal, but they also did not propose an alternative. So we listed it as not agreed entirely.
So are you saying they both did not agree and also did not object?
I'm saying, Your Honor, at the time of the filing in May, where we said it was agreed in part, they were at least reserving at that time the ability to propose a second sentence. They were not agreeing with our second sentence at that time. I will concede that. That was far from the end of the discussion on jury instructions, and there were many opportunities after that for defendant to raise objections. They did raise other objections, but they never returned to this one.
And that not agreeing in May was not enough to preserve the issue?
Our argument is that it was not enough to preserve the issue when the district court spent hours, and on the docket, this court can see, you know, every updated red line draft is on the docket. The district court went through many attempts to capture everyone's opinions on this and gave the opportunities to make a supplemental filing on the last day of trial, which defendant did. And so in the context of all that, we would say that earlier objection was not enough. Your Honors, if there aren't any other questions for me, we would urge this court to affirm the judgment.
I do have another question.
Yes, Your Honor.
What's your best evidence? I'm moving to the co-conspirator statements issue. What's your best evidence that Arroyo's offer to bribe Link would have been foreseeable to Weiss before that August 2nd meeting between Arroyo and Link?
Our best argument that the two were working together and that defendant would have foreseen Arroyo's outreach to Link is that defendant had been paying Arroyo for almost a year at that point. The payment started in November of 2018. So that is our evidence that they were working together. The defendant accompanied him to that meeting with Senator Link, and defendant was an active participant in that meeting up until the point that Link and Arroyo peeled off to have the what's in it for me discussion. Weiss presented his position on sweepstakes legislation to Senator Link, you know, in the restaurant before the other two went outside. And then certainly there is evidence afterwards that...
My question was before the August 2nd meeting. You're taking me to the moment he's driving there at, he's at the meeting, but before that.
Your Honor, we do not have any additional evidence of discussions between the two men specific to the attempt to bribe Senator Link. Mr. Arroyo did not cooperate. Mr. Weiss did not interview truthfully with law enforcement. So we have nothing else on what was in their head beyond the fact that Weiss was paying him for almost a year before. Thank you, Your Honors. We urge you to affirm the judgment and sentence of the district court.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Ms. O'Neill. Mr. Usarovic, we welcome you back to the podium. We'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you to the court. With regard to Santiago, since we just finished that issue, there was no conspiracy in the legal sense formed between Mr. Link and Arroyo because Link was an agent at the time. So there can't be a conspiracy between one individual and an undercover agent. Hence, Arroyo's statement to Link before he spoke with Weiss, it wasn't admissible it was not admissible unless there was a conspiracy, which the court asked, to bribe Link that had already existed between Link and Arroyo and Weiss. So no evidence has been presented to that fact. Indeed, you couldn't even find that because Mr. Weiss and Mr. Link I mean, Mr. Weiss and Mr. Royal were not aware of the undercover operation. Indeed, they had a conversation that concluded, and then at the direction of the FBI, Mr. Link invited Mr. Arroyo outside of the presence of Weiss and pitched that idea of a bribe. So all the evidence shows that Mr. Link was told by the FBI at the last moment to make that nudge, is what came out in trial. So Mr. Weiss was not present for that conversation. And that's the same facts in Machamedes, where the woman spoke with an undercover officer and the court found there couldn't have been conspiracy at that time. She made a prospective statement about delivering the drugs to the officer, just like Arroyo made a prospective statement about, let's talk in the future, we'll figure out the numbers and we'll get this going, and I only want to talk between the two of us, right? And later, when Mr. Weiss, so it's identical same facts, that those cannot be admitted because Mr. Weiss was not there and there was no conspiracy at the time between Mr. Weiss and Arroyo to bribe Link.
How do we factor in what the government appointed to, which was the information that Arroyo gave Weiss from Link that Weiss could not have obtained any other way, and the money that Weiss paid to both Link and Arroyo, and maintain that the district court abused its discretion by admitting Arroyo's statements that were made outside of Weiss's presence to Link.
The money and everything, that's after the fact. And that's just like Machamedes. The other conversations after that first one were admitted. And that we're not disputing that issue. We're only arguing that the main conversation shouldn't have been admitted because there was no conspiracy between Link and Arroyo. And there's no evidence to show that Link and Arroyo traveled there with a conspiracy to bribe. I mean, Arroyo and Weiss traveled to the restaurant with the idea of bribing Link or having a conspiracy at that time. There's no evidence of that. And the government said they don't have any evidence other than that. And the payments to Mr. Arroyo are not clear. He started supporting sweepstakes legislation in 2016 before the payments even occurred in 2018. With one thing I just wanted to address briefly, if I may, the Supreme Court was clear in McDonald that it's up to the jury under the facts of the case to determine whether the public official agreed to perform an official act at the time of the alleged quid pro quo. And the McDonald court clearly considered it's in the province of the jury to determine what constitutes an official act. So here, the district court did not merely provide an example of conduct that would constitute an official act as part of its explanation, but it told the jury that the conduct at issue would constitute an official act, such as promoting sweepstakes legislation. And it is so vague that it crosses over to McDonald, which says you can make phone calls, you can make meetings, you can talk to other people. So here, if someone was to act under the exceptions in McDonald's in relation to sweepstakes by talking to someone about sweepstakes, setting up a meeting about sweepstakes, taking a phone call about sweepstakes, they would then commit innocent conduct, which was criminalized by the jury instruction, not necessarily by the court.
Then help me with this, please. Jury instructions, of course, are reviewed as a whole, and the latter part of the jury instructions here included a long list of things that were not official acts. So wouldn't it be clear that promoting legislation in the jury instructions would mean pressuring, coaxing, controlling, lobbying, arm twisting, other legislators, which the district court said are core legislative functions. And, you know, these definitions didn't direct the verdict for the jury. It was still up to them, you know, to decide whether Weiss gave bribes in exchange for the promotion of gaming legislation.
Well, even though there were explanations, or otherwise if you combine the instructions together, it might be a little bit clearer and less ambiguous than just looking at that one. that doesn't really matter because it's the jury that has to determine what constitutes the official act. You can give all those instructions. That was a secondary argument saying that it's confusing. But the primary argument is you can't define the official act under McDonald and under Lindbergh, which we cited, which was the Fourth Circuit. It's up to the jury to decide what the official act is. The rest of the stuff you're allowed to define, but the official act cannot be defined. But you can give that McDonald instruction saying these are not official acts. With that, I don't have much left for the court.
Thank you.
All right. We thank both parties for your presentation today. We will take the case under advisement. We are going to take a 10-minute recess.